Marie's father is Rick Miller, who was a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and was really quite a fan of Charles Hodge. And I was pretty enthusiastic in those days about Jonathan Edwards. And I think that he thought that I needed some other perspective. And so he introduced me to two things, a section and a book called The Constitutional History of the Presbyterian Church in the USA, the 100 pages in there called The Great Revival, and also a doctrinal dissertation that came out of Brown University in 1962 called New England Calvinism and the Disruption of the Presbyterian Church in 1837. So early on, 1989-1990, I really started studying everything I could find out about not just the disruption of the Presbyterian Church, but Hodge's view of the Great Awakening. Maybe it wasn't so great. And today I'm going to analyze that, because the Great Awakening is being reassessed in our day as well. I got here a quote I'll give you later by R. Scott Clark, who teaches church history over at Westminster Seminary in Escondido. But the Princeton Seminary itself was established just a couple of years after Andover Theological Seminary. In the 18th century, theological education was included in part of the undergraduate curriculum in colleges and universities. Yale College, Harvard College, the College of New Jersey. But as the national demand and need for pastors increased, colleges such as the College of New Jersey became less concerned with producing ministerial candidates, and they weren't graduating enough pastors to meet the needs. So early in the 1800s, two Presbyterian ministers, Ashbel Green from Philadelphia, were talking about the possibility of starting a seminary that would do nothing but prepare men for the ministry. So Ashbel Green and Miller were unhappy with the administration of the College of New Jersey, which is interesting because Ashbel Green at the time was the president there, but I believe they meant as to the curriculum properly preparing men to study for the ministry. And they decided to establish a separate school. They also decided that the curriculum of this new school would supplement rather than replace a classical college education. The plan meant that the Presbyterian ministers would be among the most educated in the country. And in a minute, I'll talk about whether that was a good thing. And this is personally my opinion. This is my assessment as I studied this. And the life of Hodge is so large. He was used in so many different ways, I can just barely focus on a couple of things that stood out to me. Well, two events in 1808 propelled forward a Presbyterian movement for a theological school, and I'd mentioned one of them before when we talked about Andover Theological Seminary, and that is in 1805, a Unitarian named Henry Ware was appointed the chair of divinity at Harvard. And a group of New England Congregationalists responded to this event by opening in 1808 the first formal postgraduate theological seminary at Andover, Massachusetts. That same year, at the 1808 General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, Archibald Alexander, a pastor in Philadelphia, and he was formerly the president, as we mentioned before, of Hampton-Sidney College, where Moses Hogue also, for a while, was its president. And he preached a sermon that called on the church to establish seminaries to ensure a regular and sufficient supply of qualified ministers. And this is from the history of the Princeton Theological Seminary. It's directly from their site. In 1811, following a series of overtures and committee reports, a plan for a theological seminary was approved by the General Assembly. The guiding principle of the plan was to form a theological seminary that would be a nursery of vital piety, as well as a sound theological learning. And I really need to emphasize, personal piety was very, very important to the men who started out the seminary. That was never lacking. The General Assembly of 1812 elected a board of directors for the seminary, and Archibald Alexander was the seminary's first professor. Alexander, the first year of Princeton Theological Seminary, taught all of the classes. It wasn't until 1813 that Samuel Miller in the middle came on board to teach ecclesiology and ecclesiastical history and so on. So you could just imagine how busy Alexander was in the beginning. In August of 1812, Alexander was inaugurated and began teaching the seminary's first three students in his temporary home in Princeton. As work was concluding on Alexander Hall in 1819, the seminary built a house next to it for Alexander to live. A house for the seminary's third professor, Charles Hodge, was completed in 1825 on the opposite side of Alexander Hall. Hodge graduated from the seminary himself in 1819, so Hodge had went to the College of New Jersey, and then later he finished his education at Princeton Seminary. And he joined a faculty as an instructor in 1820 and was appointed the seminary third professor in 1822. The plan for the seminary called for at least three professors, each specializing in a different area, with the addition of Hodge to the faculty. By its 10th anniversary, 1822, the seminary's plan was fully implemented. So who was Charles Hodge? Born in 1797, an American Presbyterian theologian, he was ordained in 1821 and taught at Princeton for almost his whole life. In 1825, he founded the Biblical Repository in Princeton Review. That's a great theological magazine. One of my greatest finds when I first came to Grand Rapids was to visit Calvin Seminary, the library for the seminary, and to see the entire collection of the Biblical Repository in Princeton Review in that library. It was the first time I was able to hold numerous volumes of it in my hands and go through it. So Hodge received his degree from Rutgers in 1834 and an LLD degree from Washington College in Pennsylvania in 1864. In 1840, Hodge was transferred to the chair of didactic theology, and we're going to talk about his transition. This is just an overview, but I want to talk a minute about his conversion, and it's going to be a big part of what I want to talk about this morning. And I've been so helpful from the new biography, I believe it came out in 2012, by Andrew Hoffaker. And he says, how one interprets Charles Hodge's conversion is crucial to understanding his view of religious experience. The sequence of events in Hodge's conversion fits into what became his view of the role of revivals and conversion, and illustrates yet again a unique blend of evangelical pietism and Presbyterian confessionalism. His experience was profoundly real, but his conversion's most remarkable characteristic was how it fit into the flow of his life, its continuity with what preceded and what followed it, rather than any dramatic discontinuity between his life before and after the experience. So he was raised in a Christian home, and what the author is alluding to is there probably was not a time when Hodge would say, now I feel converted, everything is new to me, things are so different than what they were before. He may not have even been able to know for sure what the date of his conversion was. A teacher who's presently at Princeton Theological Seminary, Richard Robert Osmer, describes this view of conversion the nurture development model, because conversion comes at the end of a long development consisting of nurturing elements that we have noted in Hodge's family and church experience. Well, I'd mentioned before that a revival came to the College of New Jersey under the preaching of Ashbel Green, and Hodge witnessed his fellow students, because the College of New Jersey was in the same sorry state spiritually that Yale College was when Timothy Dwight got there. There were only eight or nine people that even made a profession. And after this revival came, many of the students now were making a profession and saying they were converted. And Hodge believed he may have been converted during that revival, but his mother, Mary, his father had already passed away, thought that he was mistaken, that he was probably converted a lot younger in what they called this nurturing covenantal children experience, which, you know, would have went over a number of years. So it's difficult to say, and I think it plays in with Hodge's critique of the Great Awakening that's in that book called The Great Revival. Hodge does not directly even mention his conversion in the autobiographical portion of The Life of Charles Hodge, which was written by his son, Archibald Alexander. While its absence does not mean that he repudiated it or denied its importance, Hoffaker says his Christian faith did not begin with his conversion at Princeton, but was in a covenantal gestation that began with his baptism and continued with catechesis, regular church attendance, and instruction from both hearth and pulpit. Such a view is summarized in the Romain report that came out in 1812. So as I've thought about these things for years, let me first give you two definitions of conversion. We're talking about the nurturing, modeling model, being raised in a Christian home and you don't know the date of your conversion, and what is often called a crisis experience conversion that Christian had as he went through the wicket gate, the burden on his back, the fears, and so on, until those fears are alleviated. They're quite different. And how somebody is converted, a lot of times that experience will determine how they look at revival, how they look at the experience of others, and so on. And so they quote this Romain report, and I found a copy of it in the Presbyterian Digest from 1873. And this is going to be an interesting thing to examine because of some of the problems that I see, not in the conversion, but how they interpret the things around them. Because in the Presbyterian model, the Paedo-Baptist model, a person becomes a covenant child, and so they're nurtured, they're brought along, and so on, and they downplay, and I'm going to show you that they downplay the crisis conversion experience as they look at revival and as they look at the experience of others who had such a crisis conversion. And this caught my eye, discipline of baptized children. So now what are you going to do? You have a child, you've baptized him, he's a covenant child, so you really believe that he's a member of the church, and yet he is not yet at an age where he can receive the Lord's table. So they had to debate such thing like, how do you discipline these baptized children? They're not able to take the Lord's table. They can't discern that, but they weren't ever even able to come to a solid decision, and these are some of the things they had to wrestle with. So Hodge on revival, while known primarily for his conservatism, his staunch advocacy of old school Calvinism, and his remark that a new idea never originated at a seminary. In other words, Hodge would say there's never been a new idea at a seminary because we're teaching the things that the men that have gone before us taught in the Westminster Confession and so on. He was leery of this idea that we've developed this new theology, and I say that to his favor. So Hoffaker believed that Hodge bridged the gap between the First Great Awakening's revivalism and the engine that drove much of American religion from its inception, and the zenith of old-school confessionalism that dominated the Presbyterian denomination in the first half of the 1800s. So Hodge was somewhat in between, so I got to define two other things. We've defined them before, but this is so much a part of what I'm communicating to you. In the 18th century, in the 1740s, about 1742, there were those who, the Presbyterians, were opposed to the experimental things that were being communicated in the Great Awakening. They were called the Old Lights. The New Light Presbyterians were favorable to the things that were communicated in such books as a Narrative of Surprising Religion by Jonathan Edwards and so on. And the men who formed what was called the Log College, William Tennant, his son William Tennant, Gilbert Tennant, and a number of these men were Presbyterians who were New Lights because they were favorable to the fact that this was indeed revival. And Hoffaker is saying that Hodge was a gap in between. As I analyze it myself, I don't think that Hodge was so much as Archibald Alexander was, because Alexander, his spiritual father, Alexander really took Charles Hodge under his arm. He spent a lot of time with him and so on. But Alexander was more favorable to a revival than Hodge was, and I'm going to try to communicate why that was. For example, Hodge in The Great Revival says, and talking about the First Great Awakening, it is evident there must have been an extraordinary influence on the minds of the people to produce such vast assemblies under the preaching of Whitfield and Edwards, Gilbert Tennant, Jonathan Dickinson, and so on. And such striking effects from the preaching of the gospel, there is no reason to doubt that there was much that was rational and scriptural in the experience of the persons thus violently agitated. Violently agitated mean they were under a great awakening. They were afraid. They were crying out, "What must we do to be saved?" In the experience of the persons thus violently agitated, yet there can be as little doubt that much of the outward effect above described was a result of mere natural excitement produced by powerful impressions made upon excited imaginations by the fervent eloquence of the preacher and propagated through the crowd by the mysterious influence of sympathy. Sympathy is what I talked to you about before, where somebody cries out in the assembly, somebody witnesses someone crying out in the assembly, and they're affected by that crying out, not necessarily the word itself. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit further, but I knew I needed to look at why there was this antagonism of R. Scott Clark, this church historian, to the Great Awakening, and so on. And if anybody's read a narrative of the surprisals of conversions, or the account of Jonathan Edwards, there's a story in there of two people in particular, Phoebe Bartlett, who was a four-year-old, who this child became under Great Awakening. She was scared for a while, and God mercifully interposed, and she was saved. And a lot of these Presbyterians who are used to this nurturing covenant child model of conversion, they don't know necessarily when they were converted, they interpret the Great Awakening by their own experience. So I saw this here by R. Scott Clark, and this is something that is worth looking into. And he's writing to somebody who is asking him, "What were your concerns about the Great Awakening?" And he's talking here about Phoebe Bartlett, the girl who was awakened. Historically, Reformed Christians have thought less in terms of religious crisis, in other words, the crisis model of conversion, especially of convulsions of the sort ascribed by Jonathan Edwards to little Phoebe, that's Phoebe Bartlett. Rather, we've tended to think in terms of covenant nurture. We neither assume nor presume that our children are necessarily converted. Well, I'm not so sure. I think that they do assume, and I think sometimes they do presume that their children are converted because they are in a covenant family, but he knows that that wouldn't set well with those who are questioning his antagonism to the Great Awakening. But neither do we look for the sort of agony experienced by Phoebe. We initiate our covenant children into the visible covenant community through the new covenant sign and seal of initiation, infant baptism. We instruct them. We include them in our public worship services as members of the visible covenant community, and we pray that the Spirit will do His mysterious work, John 3. Most of our theologians and confessions would indicate that we don't know when the Spirit works, but according to His promise, "I will be a God to you and to your children," Genesis 17, Acts 2, 39. We expect and look for fruit according to God's sovereign will. The emphasis in historic Reformed piety is on the ordinary, the ordained, and even the usual. God usually works secretly, but no less supernaturally. Now listen to this. This is so telling. Had I been Phoebe Bartlett's pastor, I would have encouraged her to trust the objective gospel promises made to Abraham and ratified in Christ's blood and signified by her baptism. I would have discouraged a sort of fear and uncertainty to which Phoebe Bartlett was led. Well, did Jonathan Edwards cause this four-year-old girl to be in fear and uncertainty? Was that something that Jonathan Edwards did? Brethren, that's something that the Holy Spirit did. She was in prayer. She became concerned about her spiritual condition. She was agitated. Her mother witnessed that. And then she said three of the things that she had memorized from the Westminster Shorter Catechism came to her and gave her comfort, and she had a crisis conversion. And some of these Presbyterians downplay that. And I'll talk about that a little bit later, but there's another thing that was very interesting to me as I studied this, and that is the whole idea of the seminary preparing men for the ministry in which the professors by the second generation and onward were no longer pastors. Now, Hodge was an ordained pastor. He had his license to preach. But more and more, the professor and the pastorate got separated. And Gardner Spring, this pastor in the Brick Church in New York City, was actually on board of the Princeton Seminary and began to have concerns about what he was seeing. Spring has spent 1 year at Andover Theological Seminary and was ordained in 1809. Well, you may not remember this, but one of classmates of Gardner Spring was Adoniram Judson. So after receiving calls from several New England parishes, he preached in Cedar Street Church in the following spring, and then the same year, by unanimous call, was invited to the pastorate of the Old Brick Church on Beekman Street in New York City. And he was continually called to other places, but he stayed there, and later on he made William Shedd his partner in the pulpit. If I could ask somebody to grab me would I be stealing somebody's water? That might be for somebody else, right?
It's okay.
All right, Betty, I'm just going to drink from this. But anyway, Spring's concern was that the people that were being graduated from Princeton Theological Seminary were academicians. They were no longer preachers so much. And he wrote a book called The Power of the Pulpit, comparing the pastorally trained ministers with those who had been trained in seminaries. The conclusion was that pastoral effectiveness was better when students spent time with the more mature ministers. Now, Gardner Spring's beliefs were summarized by John Frame. Now, that's interesting because John Frame, for years, was a professor of systematic theology and philosophy at the Reformed Theological Seminary. So years ago, John Frame found chapter 20 of this book and wanted to model a seminary after that and was so fond of this book. But it doesn't appear to be that that's what happened. But here was his 3 points: that the seminary faculty maintain close supervision, not only over a student's academic progress, but also over his social and spiritual development. Number two, that the seminary faculty itself consists of men with extensive pastoral experience. And number three, that no student be ordained to the ministry until he has spent a time of apprenticeship with an experienced pastor. Well, that's kind of the way that it used to be. Samuel Hopkins had lived in the home of Jonathan Edwards. There was that close kind of nurturing of a ministerial aspirant that was so common. And Hodge saw himself somewhat in the crosshairs of what Spring was talking about in chapter 20 of this book. But let me quote Spring again. We have intimated that the pulpit is less powerful than it was in the days of our fathers, and this acknowledgement comes to us from quarters from which it might be least expected. The existing ministry are not backward in announcing the mournful fact. One of the most venerable and experienced teachers in the theological seminary at Princeton, here he's quoting Samuel Miller, makes the following faithful statement on this subject in an address to the students in that institution, which has been read with great interest and has given great satisfaction both to the churches and their pastors. I shall offer no apology for introducing these thoughts, expressed as they are with clearness, purity, and meekness, so characteristic of their accomplished author, quote Samuel Miller. The means of more mature study and the excitements to more mature study have been constantly increasing, but both the means and excitements have been lost upon a large number of our candidates. And when a rapid improvement might have been expected, there has been a real decline, if I mistake not. It has been silently and insensibly going on. Upon every principle of proportion, we ought to be able now to bring forward numerous Presbyterian pastors prepared for the ministry at least 10 times as large as we could have been produced in the days of Jonathan Edwards, Samuel Davies, Samuel Finley. But can we produce such a list? It would rejoice my heart if I could think it possible. We cannot. However, I think so far impose upon ourselves as to deem it possible. So that got me to thinking again about Trinity Ministerial Academy. If you are not familiar with that, that was really the when the Reformed Baptist churches were in their infancy, they started a system in which they could prepare men for the ministry. So I went back to some lectures given by Albert Martin in 1983 about what was the goal of Trinity Ministerial Academy and preparing men for the ministry. And so much of what Gardner Spring says should be in proper ministerial training was found at Trinity Ministerial Academy. And another thing that was interesting about Princeton Theological Seminary, they said that not only were they going to get a seminary education to prepare them for the ministry, it would also be a classical education, so that, quote, the Presbyterians would be some of the most learned pastors in the pulpit. And I'm not really sure why that would be helpful. They were required to read the classics of Virgil and so on. They were required to read a lot of philosophy that's good or bad. And then Charles Hodge, a couple of years after he became a professor, thought that his own training was not full enough. So he left to Germany for 2 years to continue his education. And one of the reasons for that was good, and that was there was no really good Hebrew manual to learn the Hebrew language in America yet. Moses Stewart, who was at Andover Theological Seminary, had not produced one. And the other really learned Hebrew scholar was in Germany. But at the time that Hodge went to Germany to further his education, he did not have this full-blown respect and encouragement from his professors, Samuel Miller and Archibald Alexander. In the early days of American Protestantism, the training of ministerial candidates was carried on by pastors of the church. A young man filling a call of God to the ministry would associate himself with the church pastor, receive training from him, participate in the work of the parish, perhaps even live in the pastor's home. I am not sure why, but eventually this system was felt to be inadequate. Perhaps there developed a shortage of pastors able and willing to take in theological students. Perhaps as the literacy rate increased, congregations demanded clergy with more formal education, a learned ministry, as they used to say. At any rate, for some reason or other, theological training was institutionalized and at the same time academicized. They became academics, academedians. And the use of the academic model was almost inevitable. In Germany, theological education was carried on through the universities, and in fact, a university approach was the only generally recognized model available for institutionalized training in any field. So Gardner Spring had written this book and Hodge answered it, and of course Hodge tried to find reasons to disagree with it, and he said that Spring never proved his point, that there were a number of there wasn't the power in the pulpit that there used to be. There weren't the powerful preachers that there used to be. And he says, we shall scarcely be credited by those who have not read Dr. Spring's book when we say that there is no pretense of argument or evidence in support of his first and main proposition. The deterioration of the ministry is taken for granted as a notorious or admitted fact. It is, however, neither notorious nor admitted. And so on. Well, if you, and we, Lord willing, will see what became of Princeton Theological Seminary, we can find out if some of the things that concern Gardner Spring and the power of the pulpit did in fact come to pass. I hope that we could talk about that when we get to how the liberals captured the Northern Presbyterian Church by Gary North. That's a book of over 1,000 pages. What's nice about North's books is you can always get a free PDF copy. And that's something that we want to go into, but there were problems later on in the Princeton Theological Seminary. Abshire, in 1997, his name is Brian Abshire, was doing a review of North's book, and he said, old school Presbyterians destroyed themselves by compromising on certain crucial issues. Princeton Seminary represented the old school tradition, yet the practical discernment of the Princetonians, along with the will to resist error, dissipated over time. Well, why would that be? In a seminary, because the presbytery oversees it, how do you discipline somebody for heresy? That's really the job of the local church. They did, in fact, bring up two men for heresy, and in each case, it wasn't successful. In fact, they brought Albert Barnes up for heresy twice, and Lyman Beecher, as I had stated before. Well, the old Princetonians were opposed to Charles Finney and the things going on in the Second Great Awakening, but later seminary professors were supportive of D.L. Moody and Billy Sunday. The early professors rejected German textual criticism, but later seminary professors made concession to what we call lower textual criticism. And then there was a problem of how to react to evolution. While Charles Hodge attacked Darwinism, he and other Presbyterian stalwarts refused to defend the six-day creation of the Genesis record. Instead, they looked for ways to accommodate the biblical record to scientific speculations about the age of the earth. Presbyterians lost their church because they refused to impose negative sanctions against heresy. Church discipline was too painful, too uncomfortable. It took too much time and effort. And the only time they imposed it was when the rhetoric of the heretic C.A. Briggs became too much. The lesson learned was that it was okay to be a heretic as long as you were a nice guy about it. So the heretics bred and flourished, all the while crying for peace and tolerance until they gained control of the denominational machinery. But the thing that I want to close with for the remaining time is the tendency of the Paedobaptists and the Presbyterians to not accept what I'm calling the Puritan model of conversion, or that which is common in revivals. And so it made the doctrine of presumptive regeneration appealing. Well, what's presumptive regeneration? Because our child was baptized into this church. He's a covenant member of the community. We will presume that he is regenerate until clear evidence shows the contrary. So Hodge is frequently remembered for his charges in the Presbyterian Church that Finney's revivalism intruded Pelagian doctrine into the denomination, but this is Hoffaker saying this, and I wanted to find out how true this was. Not so well known is Hodge's lament. Listen to this lament about the effects, he's saying, of the Second Great Awakening. And Hoffaker, for some reason, only mentions Finney, and I think that that's not helpful because I don't believe the words Finney and Second Great Awakening should even go together. The Second Great Awakening was by men, as we talked before, Daniel Baker and Asa Hell Nettleton and others, and Edward Dorr Griffin. So Hodge, his mother, understated comments about her son's conversion at the Princeton Revival, and it reflects a similar concern. The logic of Finney's New School revivalism led to still another radical change in piety that rankled Hodge. Hodge is mourning the fact that there's a decline of infant baptism in the churches. So again, we have to define two types of conversion, the nurture development model. And I'm not downplaying that. It's really important you understand that I do believe that children brought up in a Christian home, nurtured, develop, all things being equal, in a Reformed Baptist home, we should see the same thing as well. They may not have had a crisis model of conversion that you have in the Great Awakening, and they are truly saved. On the other hand, you have a child like Phoebe Bartlett, and there's a book by the Puritan James Janeway that talks about a number of child conversions called A Token for Children. But Hodge says, Christ did not establish a criteria of a gathered church, since only God knows a heart. Listen to this. No one was permitted to demand evidence of regeneration as a prerequisite for membership. So immediately you see that Hodge, he's not naming him, but he's locking horns with Jonathan Edwards and his qualifications for communion, because Edwards says there should be some signs of regeneration. Somebody should have some kind of a testimony of his change, of his conversion, before he becomes a member of the church. But listen to the history of Princeton's teaching on presumptive regeneration. This was a problem at Princeton Seminary, A.A. Hodge. The children of all such persons, believing parents, are presumptively heirs of the blessings of the covenant of grace. The divinely appointed and guaranteed presumption is, if the parents, then the children too. This presumption is rendered exceedingly probable by the fundamental constitution of humanity as a self-propagative race. A. Hodge, Evangelical Theology, 1890, Banner of Truth, pages 324 to 337. B.B. Warfield, one of the later Princeton professors, quote, all Protestants should easily agree that only Christ's children have a right to the ordinance of infant baptism. We say that if the church should receive as the children of Christ, all whom in the judgment of charity it may fairly recognize as such, all baptism is inevitably administered on the basis not of knowledge but of presumption. If we must baptize on presumption, the whole principle is yielded. We must baptize all whom we may fairly presume to be members of Christ's body. So soon, therefore, as it is fairly apprehended that we baptize on presumption and not on knowledge, it is inevitable that we shall baptize all those for whom we may, on any grounds, fairly cherish a good presumption that they belong to God's people. This surely includes the infant children of believers. End quote. B.B. Warfield, the Polemics of Infant Baptism. Again, among the Reformed alone, regarding the invisible church of the people of God, membership is mediated not by the external act of baptism, but the internal regeneration of the Holy Spirit. In the case of infants dying in infancy, birth within the bounds of the covenant is a sure sign, since a promise is unto us and our children. End quote. Studies in Theology, pages 429, 447. Lyman Atwater, a later professor and also one of the most prolific authors of articles in the biblical repertory, says, quote, if our children are in precisely the same position as others, why baptize them? Children of the Covenant and their part in the Lord, Biblical Repertory in Princeton Review, Charles Hodge. The historic Reformed doctrine, which may be identified with that of John Calvin, was as follows. Membership in the invisible church meant vital union with Christ or regeneration by the Holy Spirit. Since the word presume meant to admit a thing to be or to receive a thing as true before it could be known as such from its phenomena or manifestations, the presumption that an infant was a member of the invisible church meant that it was believed to be engrafted into Christ and regenerated before it gave any ordinary evidences of the fact. The Church Membership of Infants, page 375. So I went in and I dug that article out in 1858, and I'm reading this stuff. And of course, as a Baptist, it really agitates me inside. He says it is easy to see, in the light of these elementary principles, the fallacy of the common argument of our Baptist friends against the church membership of infants. They say that because regeneration or saving union with Christ, the condition of actual church membership in the sight of God, therefore children who cannot give evidence of such regeneration are not to be regarded or treated as church members. But we are required to treat as members of the church many who are not regenerated. And Hodge is arguing that, in fact, we should. We don't know their hearts. We can't say for sure whether they are regenerated, and so we are going to assume it, and they should be brought into the membership of the church. A.A. Hodge, but baptism does not ordinarily confer grace in the first instance, but presupposes it. Outlines of Theology, 629, John Murray. Baptized infants are to be received as the children of God and treated accordingly. Christian Baptism, page 59. And so, again, I want to reiterate that I do believe that there is a covenant nurturing model, not that they're children of the covenant, but that to their point that if they're nurtured, they're raised in a Christian home, they're exposed to these things, God often does convert these children. But what happens, as I say, in the case of R. Scott Clark and so on, who hardly knows anybody that had a crisis experience conversion, awakening like Christian in Pilgrim's Progress, they take their view of conversion and what happened to them, and they impose it upon others, and they look it as suspicious when these type of things are brought forth. But I think it's a big mistake, because many Presbyterian pastors were pastors during awakenings, and they give details of God's awakenings to these people. As I said last week, in the case of Daniel Baker, there's two volumes of his revival sermons. And if you look in the appendix, there's numerous stories of people that were converted. And they had this great awakening. They had these fears come upon them. And I'm sure this was a view of most of the Puritans, starting with William Perkins in his work on Cases of Conscience, of how the Holy Spirit enlightens somebody, convicts them of a sin, and a law work is begun, and in the end, conversion ensues. And in our day, it's always been a lament to me that you don't hear much anymore about these crisis conversions. Very rarely do people say that they knew a time of being awakened under a law work. Anything like what David Brainerd mentions in his own conversion, or Asahel Nettleton. But anyway, to go on a little bit, and we can get into this next week when we continue our study of what happened to Princeton Theological Seminary and Kevin Reed on the decline of Presbyterianism in a review of Gary North's work, Cross Fingers. This book illustrates numerous problems connected to seminary training, such as the inordinate influence of seminary professors and the trouble created when seminaries are insulated from the effective control of the church courts. When you combine these factors with the requirement of seminary training for ministers, as modern Presbyterians do, you have a prescription for a disaster. In other words, there's not the accountability that there needs to be often in the training of men for the ministry. And why? Well, seminaries need money, and sometimes they let their guard down as who they receive into the seminary. And I'm not making a universal condemnation of all seminaries. I'm just saying that this is a tendency that can happen, and that's why I understand why Trinity Ministerial Academy was formed in the late 1970s, early 1980s. Gary North examines the inherent problem created when ministerial candidates are initially required to have a degree from an accredited university. In other words, before a man even reaches seminary, he's expected to be well-schooled in the academic humanism of our culture. Why should this be a requirement for the ministry? The goal for an educated ministry is equated with a ministry of academic degrees. The trend toward formal academic training led to another development within American Presbyterianism, the declining significance of presbyterial exams. A seminary degree was virtually a passport into the ministry. What they're saying at this point is that you've gotten this degree now from a seminary, and we will hire you sight unseen. The ministerial aspirant doesn't go to a church. He's not examined for an extended time to see if he has those things which constitute a call to the ministry. The seminary degree was his passport. He doesn't need that examination. There was a desperate need to guard the gate into the ministry at the presbytery level. Yet the old school Presbyterians found themselves powerless to block the entry of heterodox men onto the rolls of the presbyteries. So part of North's keen analysis is in showing how the modernists were able to use the new school experientialists against the more doctrinally precise members of the old school. Well, he had built up his argument by saying because they refused to discipline heretics. And so these liberals were able to enter into our seminaries. It is a maxim of politics, ecclesiastical or otherwise, that the soft middle constitutes a swing vote. The large, less committed middle will decide which way the organization goes. As a vast majority of men in the church became largely indifferent to confessional dogma, and that's what I could say in Hodge's favor. In the split of the church in 1837, Hodge was very, very dogmatic about adhering to the Westminster Confession and the Catechism and so on, but that began to decline. In fact, it's an interesting story that when Machen was received into originally Princeton Theological Seminary, they never even required that he made a confession that he held to the Westminster Confession. Thankfully that he did. So anyway, Hodge claimed that revivalists in the Second Great Awakening did not place enough emphasis on the role of the church to nurture children. But again, Hofacker only mentions Charles Finney. What about Asahel Nettleton, who we have discussed, and Daniel Baker, also used in the Second Great Awakening? Daniel Baker wrote, "Under my ministry, the church was much blessed. In a short time, the membership increased considerably. Moreover, as was usual with me, when invited, I visited other churches," and so on. So with Daniel Baker, everything was done within the context of a local church, though because our country was very young, he was used as a missionary and invited to other places. But Daniel Baker and Asahel Nettleton never put down the pastors in those assemblies. They helped to build these churches up. An amazing statement by Hodge that I already mentioned. "We do not assert these children, their regeneration, or that they are true members of Christ's body. We only assert that they belong to the class of persons whom we are bound to regard and treat as members of Christ's church. This is the only sense in which even adults are members of the church so far as men are concerned." And so in closing, this is really what concerned me about what was going on in the Presbyterian churches and Hodge's emphasis, that since God has not given to men the power to read the heart, he has not imposed on his people the obligation to sit in judgment on the regeneration of their fellow men. Consequently, we not only are not required, but we are not allowed to demand evidence of regeneration satisfactory to ourselves as a condition of church membership. In other words, Christ is not committed to men the impossible task of making a church which shall consist exclusively of the regenerate. Well, what the Paedo-Baptist argument to us is, because we say you are allowing these children into the church and you're calling them members and they may not be regenerate. And their argument is, well, you have unregenerate persons in your churches as well. There's going to be tares among the wheat. But the proper analogy is that some people are in Russian prisons because they are guilty, but some people are there because of the laws. They put them in there even though that they are innocent. There's not a proper examination. And we say that children are being brought into these Paedo-Baptist churches that don't show any signs of regeneration because that's the law that you have made for them, that we can't judge them. But in the Baptist churches, though we may have unregenerate people in our membership, it's in spite of the way that we've tried to guard the church that they came in. Presumptive regeneration is going to inevitably allow a lot of unregenerate persons into the church. There was a paper written about 20, 25 years ago, and I wanted to look at it again, called "Is God the God of the Mature Professing Christian Only?" by a student named Mark Horn, who was going to Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. And it was really a troubling paper. It was the first time that Paedo-Baptists ever made the comments that covenant children can fall out of the covenant if they're not faithful. But this is a dig at Baptists. He's answering a man named Greg Welty, also a Baptist student in a seminary. He says, Finally, if I have raised my child as a Christian, what right do I have to demand a prayer of conversion? Do I presume that my four-year-old is trusting in his own good works to save him and must repent of legalism? Do I presume he is a hypocrite living in sin? Do I presume he is lying when he claims to love and trust Jesus as I have taught him to? This demand for some sort of conversion experience needs to be seen for what it is, a requirement of, this is what he says, good works over and above simple childlike faith. And or a satanic accusation burdening the consciences of our little brothers and sisters in the Lord. Think about that for a minute. We are being harangued because we will not be satisfied as parents with anything less than the highest assurance of our child's faith reality. We want to see the fruits of the faith. And he is saying that, how could you demand such a conversion experience? We're not looking for the crisis model testimony. We just want to see the fruits of the conversion. And he says we're unloving to our children because we do that, that we don't pronounce them covenant children, that we don't allow them membership into the church and so on. So this is what he says. How dare you, Baptists, separate the children from their own parents in the covenant community? They are your own flesh and blood. Flesh and blood. Flesh and blood is the problem. Our children are born of the flesh, the depraved Adamic nature. They are conceived sinful and guilty. Baptism is supposed to separate children from their parents. The entire horizon of discourse is so far out of orbit, I don't know how to respond. Well, Mr. Welty wrote that Baptist parents also bring their children under the same influence of preaching, catechizing, and family instruction. So what's the point? And I've often said that to Pado Baptists, all things being equal, I catechize my child, I pray for my child, I have my Baptist child and family devotions and so on. Are you saying that because you've given him this covenant sign of baptism to an infant, that it's now more probable that God is going to convert your children? Even granted that you don't hold to the idea of a presumptive regeneration. But I believe, in closing, that there was already a change between the first generation of professors at Princeton Theological Seminary and Charles Hodge and later persons as they were looking at this whole model. Because in Archibald Alexander's work, Thoughts on Religious Experience, it says, there is no necessity for any other proof of native depravity than the aversion which children early manifest to pious instruction and to spiritual exercises. And I thought, you know, coming from Alexander, that's pretty amazing. His sons were very, very good men. They went on to be J.W. Alexander and J.A. Alexander. But Alexander says, from this cause, innate depravity, it perceives that many children who have the opportunity of a good pious education learn scarcely anything of the most important truths of Christianity. If they are compelled to commit the catechism to memory, they are accustomed to do this without ever thinking of the doctrines contained in the words which they recite. So that when the attention is at any time awakened to the subject of religion as a personal concern, they feel themselves to be completely ignorant of the system of divine truth taught in the Bible, end quote. He's saying that that's a sign that the mind of the infant and child has been affected by the fall. And so Alexander teaching this was more favorable to the Second Great Awakening. He pastored during that time. And it just seems to me that from the second generation of Princeton Theological Seminary onward, the pressing the gospel to the children's conscience and not being satisfied with anything less than fruit being the effect of the new birth seemed to be downplayed. And I tried to establish that in Hodge's own words, that we don't even need to look for the fruit of regeneration because we can't know their hearts. Well, Jesus said, by their fruits you shall know them. Well, there's so much of Hodge's life I'm not able to get into this week, but these two things stood out to me because they are questions that I've had on this whole subject going now on 30 years.